The commission will now go on the record and come to order. We're convening an open session Wednesday, March 24th, 2010, to hear oral argument in the matter entitled The Secretary of Labor versus Eastern Associated Coal Corporation. The docket numbers are Lever 2007 through 335. Present are myself, Chairman Jordan, Commissioner Duffy, Commissioner Young, and Commissioner Cohen. By the terms of the commission order setting oral argument, each side has been allotted 30 minutes for the presentation of its argument. The Secretary of Labor shall proceed first and may reserve up to 5 minutes of her designated time for rebuttal. Will counsel please introduce themselves for the record?
I'm Ed Waldman for the Secretary.
Thank you.
R. Henry Moore, the law firm Jackson Kelly, PLLC, for Eastern Associated Coal Corporation.
Thank you. Mr. Walter, would you like to proceed?
May it please the Commission. First, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Yeah.
This case is about an inadequate roof support violation. The ALJ found that the violation was established and that it was a significant and substantial violation, but the ALJ found that the violation was not an unwarrantable failure. And that's the issue on appeal, whether the ALJ erred in finding that there was not an unwarrantable failure. The events in question took place in an underground coal mine operated by Eastern Associated Coal Corporation called the Federal No. 2 Mine. In particular, the events in question took place in an area that's known as the 7 Right Empty Track Entry. This entry, which was mined in the 70s and currently serves as storage for empty coal cars, is 16 feet wide and approximately 7,000 feet long, and it has a set of trolley car tracks or rail car tracks running down the middle of the entry. And on the left-hand side is trolley wire suspended from the roof, and on the right-hand side, there's a walkway. The MSHA inspector, Mr. Jason Reinhardt, in the course of his routine inspection of this area, found that there were 7 areas of the roof that were inadequately supported. 4 of them were due to sloughage off the ribs, 2 of them were due to potting out from the roof, and, four of them were due to sloughage off the ribs, 2 were from potting out on the roof, and 1 was from a combination of sloughage and potting out. Now, an unwarrantable failure, of course, is aggravated conduct that is more than ordinary negligence. The Commission's case law establishes a number of factors that an ALJ is required to consider in the course of an unwarrantable failure analysis. And those are the degree of danger of the violative condition, the obviousness of it, the extent of it, the duration of it, whether the operator had knowledge of the violative condition, whether the operator had knowledge that greater compliance efforts were necessary, and the operator's abatement efforts. The ALJ found that the violation, which was consisting of these 7 inadequately supported areas, were both highly dangerous and obvious. However, the ALJ found that the extent of the violation, found that the violation was not extensive. But in doing so, the ALJ employed a method of calculation that resulted in an understatement of the area of the inadequately supported roof by a factor of nearly 6. The ALJ found The ALJ calculated the area of the inadequately supported roof to total 209 square feet. According to the secretary, that should have been 1,198 feet. So the difference is almost six times. That error in and of itself is significant enough to warrant reversal in the secretary's view.
When you say reversal, you mean that if we were to find, as you've calculated, the roof area, that just based on the calculation of the roof area, it would be unreasonable for the judge to have added up the other factors and assigned them the weight that he had and find that it was not an unwarrantable failure. Is that correct?
That's correct, but we think the ALJ also erred on some of the other factors as well.
But you're saying if we were to find this to be an error, it should be reversed based on that alone?
That's correct.
It seems you're looking at an area problem. You can't really look at bad roof and just add it up as a math problem, can you? I mean, doesn't it matter where the roof is, how severe the hazards are? Don't you have to take that into account?
Absolutely. And the ALJ found that the hazard was severe and it was obvious and that it lasted for 7 days.
But what about the exposure to the miners in terms of where the location was of these hazards?
Yeah, the ALJ addressed that too in the course of his S&S analysis. He found that there were three pre-shift examinations every day. There was a pumper or pump mechanic who was in there at least once every day. There were two maintenance people assigned to that track who were in there regularly. And there were also motormen, trackmen, track bolters, electricians, who were all in there regularly. So the ALJ did find that there was miners were in there regularly and were exposed to the inadequately supported roof.
Are the maintenance men that you're referring to the same maintenance men that maintain the roof?
That's not clear from the record. I don't know the answer to that, honestly. I don't know. Now, the difference between the ALJ's calculation and the secretary's is as follows. In first of all, with respect to the areas that potted out, we have no problem with the ALJ's method of calculation there, but the ALJ did neglect to include one of the three areas that had potted out, in fact, the largest of the three areas that had potted out, when he added up the numbers. With respect to the areas where there was sloughage from the ribs, the secretary has an issue with the method of by which the ALJ calculated the area. What the ALJ did was find that because sloughage from the ribs had increased the width of the entry by 1 foot, that there was 1 foot of inadequately supported roof, and then he multiplied that 1 foot by the length, which was approximately 15 feet in all six locations. And the ALJ concluded, therefore, that you had 90 square feet that was affected by sloughage from the ribs. But that finding is inconsistent with what the ALJ found in the course of his findings on the violation itself and the S&S issue as well. He found specifically, crediting the Inspector Reinhardt's testimony, that when the width of the entry is extended as a result of sloughage from the ribs, that the integrity of the entire width of the roof structure at that point is compromised. The ALJ credited that testimony, and he specifically credited that testimony over the contrary testimony of Eastern's safety supervisor, Dan Curry. Now, Eastern has questioned Mr. Reinhardt's qualifications to make such a judgment regarding the integrity of the roof structure. The ALJ found those qualifications were sufficient, and in this particular case, I think it's difficult to question that. Mr. Reinhardt had a Bachelor of Science degree in safety engineering. He had a Master's of Science degree in safety management. He had the standard MSHA inspector training at the academy, 3 weeks, and he has been an MSHA inspector for, had been at the time, an MSHA inspector for over 10 years. The ALJ's decision that Mr. Reinhardt's qualifications were sufficient to credit his testimony on that issue is supported by substantial evidence and within his purview as the finder of fact and crediting witnesses. So the ALJ's finding then about the integrity of the roof structure being compromised by the sloughage of 1 foot undermines his own finding then when he comes to the unwarrantable issue and doesn't take that into account. And instead he looks simply at the narrow 1 foot rather than the entire width of the structure.
Counselor, if you could address the issue. You said the ALJ relied on an area of about 209 square feet in determining how extensive the violation was. And the Secretary contends that a more correct calculation would bring it up to almost 2,000 or 1,900.
No, it was
1,198 square feet. But the ALJ compared the 209 square feet to the whole entry, which mm-hmm. I think you said was about 7,000.
Correct.
In determining that it's not extensive. Even if we adopted the calculation proposed by the Secretary, would you maintain that that brings it into the extensive description of an extensive violation, given that the entry is still 7,000 feet long?
Yes. The ALJ's comparison of the square footage of the inadequately supported roof area to the total area of the entry, the Secretary believes was unreasonable under the facts of this case. That the hazard would have been the same whether that entry was half of its 7,000 feet or double its 7,000 feet or 10 times 7,000 feet for that matter. The hazard was still the same.
And why is the Secretary wasting so much time on the 1,198 square feet versus 209 over a denominator of 112,000 square feet? Why are we getting into numbers in the first place? If, as you say, no matter where it is, no matter how big each individual incidence of bad roof is, that the calculation should not have been made by the judge, then why waste so much brief time discredited the judge's map and introducing your own?
What the Secretary believes was not relevant was the ratio of comparing the area of the inadequately supported roof to the overall length entry. What is relevant is the actual area of inadequately supported roof. The ALJ found 209 square feet. The Secretary thinks it's 1,198 square feet. So it's a six-fold error. That's what's important. It doesn't really matter in the Secretary's view how long the entry is because the amount of the hazard is fixed by the size of the area affected.
But if you're using that, aren't you basically saying that somewhere there's a magic number where this is just too much roof that's not been addressed? What if we review the record and look at it and find that your math is wrong? Where do we know where that magic number is? It's somewhere between 209 and 1,200 feet. How are we supposed to figure that out? I mean, I've got a little bit of a problem with using this area calculation and assigning too much weight, just as it seems like Commissioner Duffy does.
Well, I could agree with you that there's a problem in drawing the line, and there's also a problem when you get into the math here, because there's a lot of different ways you can slice and dice the numbers. I think the important thing is the concept. The ALJ, when he looked at the area of inadequately supported roof, he looked at simply this narrow area where the ridge sloughage had actually occurred. And he found that that was the only area where there was inadequately supported roof for purposes of his extent analysis. In the Secretary's view, the proper analysis would have been to recognize that the fact that that material has sloughed off of the ribs and extended the width of the entry by a foot compromises not just that 1 foot, but it compromises the rest of the entry at that location as well. And that's the key concept. It doesn't matter really so much what the numbers are.
I can follow you, counsel, as far as the fact the violation is concerned. I'm having difficulty with determining whether those kinds of considerations contribute to the unlawful failure finding. And I'm looking at the Emory case where there were instances of roof bolts being separated from the roof, but the commission looked at the overall adequacy of the roof control maintenance program of the company and said in relation to that, it did not constitute unlawful. And I'm perfectly with you and with the judge on the fact that this was violative. I'm tending to agree with the judge that it didn't rise to the level of unwarrantable based on its analysis.
Well, the commission's case law...
Eastern is saying that, you know, 7 feet versus 6 feet between the one bolt and the rib isn't that violative. The secretary is saying, oh, yes, it is, and the judge agrees, and so do I. Technically speaking, it's beyond the 6 foot. But my problem is making the leap to the unwarrantable failure finding on top of that.
No, I understand your point of view, Commissioner Duffy, but also remember that the ALJ in his violation finding and in his S&S finding specifically found, crediting Inspector Reinhardt's testimony, that sloughage of 1 foot off the sides compromised the integrity of the entire width. And that's the problem with the ALJ then when he gets to unwarrantable, going back and saying, well, it was really only this 1 foot. Some of the other factors that the ALJ erred on as well, the next one I'd like to discuss is the duration factor. ALJ found that this violent condition had lasted for, quote, more than a few days. I take that to mean a week, roughly. I think that's a reasonable understanding of what the ALJ has said. Nevertheless, the ALJ seemed to weigh that duration against the secretary in the unwarrantable failure determination, because when the ALJ got to the weighing of all the factors together...
Excuse me, Mr. Walden.
Yes.
The judge didn't find a week. The judge just spoke of more than a few. I think so.
That's
you
right.
Say you take it to be, I'm not...
That's my opinion. That's what I'm saying. More than a few days to me means 1 week. If you say a few days, it's 3 or 4 or 5. If you say more than a few days, it's 6 or 7. If you were going to say, you know, if you meant 8 days, you would have said more than a week. I don't know. I'm just trying to make sense of what the decision says. Because when the ALJ weighs all the factors together, and he talks about duration, what he says was the evidence was insufficient to establish more than a few days, and seems to weigh it against the secretary somehow. But if you understand the more than a few days finding to mean roughly a week, that means that Eastern had roughly 21 pre-shift examinations in which to find this violation, and it failed. If it's failed 20 or 21 times or even 18 times to find this violation, to me, that's more than ordinary negligence. And when it's weighed together with the high danger and obviousness that the ALJ found and the extent that I've argued about already, then you've got an unwarrantable failure in the secretary's view.
Suppose the judge's view of more than a few days is 4 days or 5 days. Is that a sufficient period of time to constitute a serious lack of reasonable care or worse?
Well, then you're talking about 12 to 15 opportunities for Eastern on its pre-shift examinations to have noted these areas of inadequately supported group. I think, yes, that is still more than an adequate number of opportunities to have found it, and its failure to do so 12 to 15 times still would be more than ordinary negligence. Failing to find it 2, 3, 4 times maybe would be ordinary negligence.
Yes, that issue, I think the judge found that they were not, he didn't find they had knowledge, at least they had knowledge of the violated condition, I believe. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But I do take your point that maybe if at what point should one impute knowledge of a condition? If indeed there are pre-shift exams going on, and you said before each shift is a pre-shift exam?
Correct.
And people are going by and inspecting this area and not denoting, making note of a condition that the judge has determined is obvious and exposes minors to danger. That seems to me to, you know, raise an issue then. I mean, is that finding even supported by substantial evidence? The judge is finding that they didn't have knowledge of the condition.
Does
it take somebody actually taking them by the hand and saying that the condition was pointed out to them, or that it was, is the only time you can find knowledge is if something is written in the pre-shift report? Because then if somebody fails to write it in the pre-shift report, not once, not twice, but 15 or 20 times, I think, you know, there's an issue there.
And that was going to be my next point, Chairman Jordan. The ALJ's finding regarding knowledge is erroneous in the Secretary's view as well. And there is, obviously, as you allude to, some tension between the ALJ's finding that the violative condition was obvious and his finding that Eastern nevertheless didn't have knowledge of it. And I'll admit that they didn't have actual knowledge of it. That's pretty clear from the record. But it's also fairly clear, I think, that they should have had knowledge. And Eastern argues in its brief that a should-have standard is not good enough for unwarrantable, and cites three cases. But if you read those cases, all three of them say simply that a should-have standard, or that the operator should have known of a condition, is not in and of itself sufficient to establish an unwarrantable failure. But there is case law by the Commission, including a case, interestingly, against Eastern Associated Coal Corporation, specifically holding that an unwarrantable failure can stem from a condition that the operator should have known about. That's the Eastern Associated Coal case at 13 in the blue, volume 13 in the blue book, page 178 is the case, and page 187 is the relevant point. And also the commission's, that's a fairly old case, as you can tell from the 13 number, but there's also much more recent commission case law on that point. The San Juan case in 2007 says the same thing, and that's at 29 in the blue books, page 125. So the two factors, in addition to that, the two factors that the Secretary relies on for establishing knowledge on the part of Eastern is, one, that Mr. Curry, the safety supervisor who testified for Eastern, acknowledged that there is a weatherization problem in this mine that they've known about for decades, and that they routinely, in the past at least, have attended to properly by installing additional roof bolts, posts, cribs, straps in between the bolts, and so forth. But the fact that they've done a good job of maintenance in the past doesn't necessarily mean that they did it this time. It appears that this time they dropped the ball.
Is that a measure of their overall indifference? The fact that they did have some sort of systematic roof control program for this entry? I mean, they actually bolted the day before the citation was issued, correct?
They put in 15 bolts in that entry, and not one of the seven locations, but a different location the day before. That's correct. And that fact, taken together with the fact that they've done similar things over the past 20-plus years in that entry, it's not necessarily going to show indifference. What it's going to show is knowledge. What it shows is that they knew.
But ultimately, there's a higher standard than simple knowledge. That's indifference, recklessness, failure to take necessary actions, and it seems to me they're sort of damned if they do, damned if they don't. The more supplemental roof support they added in during the 20 or 30 years that entry was in existence seems to be held against them here.
It's true that you've got to show more than ordinary negligence and indifference and reckless disregard and those standards that you mentioned, Commissioner Duffy, but it's also true that one of the factors the commission has specified must be required, must be considered in an unwarrantable failure analysis is knowledge. And that,
I don't follow, frankly, why bolting 1,000 feet from the conditions at issue here signifies knowledge.
Because it's a concrete example of the fact that Eastern knew that there was a problem throughout the entry with weatherization, that they needed to bolt and put in posts and cribs and straps as they had done over the years. And given the fact that, you know, you can't consider any one of these factors in isolation. You also have to consider how dangerous it was, how obvious it was, and the fact that they had 12 to 15 or 18 to 21 opportunities to see this before, in light of the fact that they know there's a problem with weatherization that they have attended to over the years.
Well, go ahead, please.
I mean, yeah, it's an old entry and it has to be maintained.
Exactly.
I mean, that's all, it seems to me, the point you're making in terms of knowledge. I mean, it was an old entry, they have to be aware that things, conditions are going to occur from an old entry. Things are going to weaken, roof sloppage is going to occur, bolts are going to, need to be attended to. Was this bolting that was done the day before? Or are you saying, was that in by the areas in question, that somebody would have them going in by and see these other conditions? Is that the point you're making? Or just that they knew they had to maintain the entry generally? I mean, I don't follow the 1,000-foot, the bolting 1,000-foot away is relevant to the knowledge.
May I proceed through my red light?
Sorry, I missed the yellow one. Yes, you would mind answering, and then I know my colleague had a question, too, that
The 15 roof bolts that were put in the day before were apparently put in right at the very top of the 7-right empty track.
Excuse me, not top, by top, is that... Would that be more out by?
It's in by. It's all the way. It's at the furthest point in the entry that's in by.
Okay.
And that was...
Where in terms of the car numbers?
At the lowest. I think it was estimated to be 8 to 10 by Eastern's witness.
Okay.
Or 6 to 10, I think. So somewhere in that neighborhood. And, I'm sorry, I take that back. The estimate of 6 to 10 was the difference between where the 15 roof bolts were put in and where the first of the 7 areas cited by the inspector was. So there was 6 to 8 entries in between. But where the 15 bolts were put in was the very beginning. So it would be car markers 1 through 2 and 3 or something like that. It wasn't specified at the hearing.
Just one question real quickly. You talked about the opportunities they had to see and observe these conditions 12 to 21 times in the pre-shifts, et cetera, but isn't the weatherization indicative of an ongoing deterioration problem with the roof? And isn't it a fact that the record isn't really clear about when some of this deterioration that was cited as a violation here might have occurred? I mean, we don't really have clear records as part of the problem here. Isn't that fair to say?
No, because the ALJ made a finding on that, and the ALJ found more than a few days. If you don't want to take that as a week, that's fine. But the ALJ did make a finding. I mean, I'll admit that the evidence of record is not crystal clear, but the ALJ looked at it and made a reasonable inference that it was more than a few days.
As to all of the conditions.
That's correct. And I don't think I finished answering Chairman Jordan's question. That's okay. I had barely just begun. The only point I really want to make is that the Commission's case law in the San Juan case that I mentioned a few moments ago specifically holds that in order to impart knowledge to an operator, a previous violation doesn't have to be in the same area that the current violation is. So the fact that it's 1,000 feet away in the same entry, at least under my reading of the San Juan case, is really not a factor that detracts significantly from the Secretary's argument regarding knowledge.
Well, wait a second. That area 1,000 feet away was not a violation. That was something that the company took upon itself to remedy. It wasn't cited, correct?
You're talking about the 15 volts?
Yes.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that, Commissioner Duffy, but I would say that, you know, taking a compliance measure compared to a violation, it's really two sides of the same coin. I mean,
I don't know. That's the whole point of this act. We heard yesterday that we're in a mode of find and fix as opposed to see and cite. Well, this is one where they found it and fixed it, correct?
I wasn't here yesterday.
that was the policy as enunciated by the new assistant secretary, so I thought maybe you'd want to know.
Okay. I appreciate that, Commissioner Duffy.
Well, I want to ask you about another thing of the record. There's citation number 6602109 was a violation of section 75.360A1 for an inadequate pre-shift exam on this day. And that was due in part to the failure to note the seven areas of inadequate roof support. That violation was settled prior to trial. And I'm wondering what you think about whether Eastern's acceptance of that violation reflects at all on Eastern's knowledge of the inadequate areas themselves. Is that clear or expected?
It's very clear, and I'll just let the record speak for itself on that. The Commission can draw whatever inference it would like. I don't suggest that. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Commission, this is an empty track, and it happened on this particular day not to have empties stored in it. But normally there are empties stored in it.
Counsel, can you just clarify, it was on that part of the record, the mine was on vacation,
yes.
And that's why the cars weren't in the track. And I had a little bit of trouble. It seemed like it should be the other way around.
while they were on vacation. Now, one of the things, and we all, I guess, both have to apologize, is this case was tried 2 years after the order was issued, and there are probably some deficiencies in the record just because of the lapse of time. Having said that, what the testimony was that they were on vacation, and there was limited coal being produced in the mine, at the other end of the mine, and that those cars were there essentially to take that coal and to store it. We do not have anything on the record on how long vacation was. What we do know is this is an empty track. It is removed from the active areas of the mine where the miners travel to the active sections, and it is essentially used for storage. And if it is used for storage, that creates some certain issues as to how you examine it and the like.
Still had miners exposed to the hazard, right?
We had miners who were in the entry. We had pre-shift examiners. There is a question in my mind, if you listen to the secretary, we had hordes of people in there, but I don't believe the record supports that. Yes, there were pumps in the area, but there was a track that was parallel to the seven empty track, which was a track that got traveled, and there were ways to access the seven empty track by riding on the parallel haulage way and coming over in. So again, the pumpers aren't necessarily traveling the whole empty track. The maintenance people that we talked about, as far as I understand this record, they are the two gentlemen who are assigned to this area to maintain it on an ongoing basis. They are track bolters. They also happen to be people who will do track-related work that you might have to do in this area. Now, but it is an empty track, and that means there is not a great deal of traffic in there. As the miner representative testified, he said, well, the traffic is in another area of the mine. Now, we need to back up. We talked about the six factors, and the secretary challenges the judge's finding on the three factors. Well, let's back up for a moment, I think, and look at the overall picture. We have an entry that is 30 years old. If there's any doubt about that, both respondents, Exhibit 1 and 2, have dates on it as to when the mining occurred. We have an entry that was maintained on a routine basis over those 30 years. Now, one of the deficiencies in the records from both sides is we aren't able to identify all the supplemental support that was installed over the years. But we do know that the original bolting pattern was three bolts across with straps in between, which is a form of supplemental support. We also know that on an ongoing basis, they were diligent about maintaining this entry. They had people assigned to it. It wasn't an entry that was ignored. When we talk about extent, what the discussions of extent, in a sense, prove that none of us can add. We've all flunked math. The secretary says the judge flunked math. He left out the area car marker 239. Now, that's an interesting one that I'll get to in a few minutes.
Mr. Moore, before you get to the map,
yes.
More fundamentally, you would agree that the judge based his analysis of extensiveness solely on a calculation of the ratio of unsupported roof to the full area of roof in the 7,000 feet of the entry.
Yes.
Okay. Do you believe that the commission, in evaluating the extensiveness of a condition for purposes of an unwarrantable failure analysis, is limited to a comparison such as the judge made here?
I don't think it's limited to it. I think the secretary is right in that you can use numbers in any number of ways here. What we do know is there were seven fairly limited areas. They were segregated.
Well, let me just stop you there. If the ratio is important, if this were like a 15,000-foot-long main entry, and you had some problems in the roof somewhere in it, then you wouldn't ever find that it was extensive, would you? If the ratio is the kind of the touchstone of the analysis.
Well, this is a 7,000-foot entry, and I think you have to take into account the extent of the entry and the extent of the area that we're talking about. Since this is an empty track, I think it is appropriate to say that the entire 7,000-foot entry should be taken into account.
Why did that matter, whether it's an empty track or not?
Well, because it's all the same examination, it's the same maintenance people. It's in and of itself a nice segregated area.
So you can see, well, at least we don't have to take into ratio like the roof of the whole mine, say. Like this part of the roof was unsupported, but if we look at the roof in the whole mine and the square footage, then it's not very extensive. I mean, I don't see how a violation could ever be extensive if we look at a ratio like this of a whole entry.
I think, as I understand the extensiveness criteria, since we have a separate severity criteria. In a sense, when we're talking about extensiveness, we're talking about really how easy is it to see it? How much would it jump out at you? And if you were examining this area, it's a 7,000-foot entry. When you're writing the book, that's what you say. I examined the seven right empty track. I think that if you don't take that into account, even if you chop it up into seven blocks. The problem with seven blocks is these aren't very long entries. You could, rather than, as we've done, gone through, rather than a square foot area, because $112,000 sounds a lot more than $7,000. You can go on linear because that's how the person examines it. They go down the entry. They go down the entry either in a vehicle or they have to walk it. And if they have to walk it, they're walking on one side with a car in between. And the majority of these conditions are on the wire side. And they have a wire hanging down from the roof with a guard over it.
You sort of said that it's how much it makes, the violations jump out at you. I think
yes.
That's your words. And you were suggesting...
To put it simplistically, Commissioner. To put it simplistically, yes.
Oh, I need it that way.
So do I.
And you suggested that the seven areas were spread out.
Yes.
And as I look at the record, number four area is at 108 to 110 car mm-hmm. markers. Number five is at 108 to 107. And number six is at 105. And that number four had 15 feet on both sides. Number five had 12 feet on the walkway side, not the wire side.
Yes.
And number six had 12 feet on the, again, the walkway side, which is a total of 54 linear feet, adding all of
yes.
that together. And if I assume that, I think the record said that car markers are about 21 feet apart.
That's what the record said, yes.
That would be from 105, marker 105 to 110 would seem to be 105 feet. So it would suggest that within this 105 linear feet, there were 54 linear feet, or approximately half of it, that was
yes.
implicated in a bad area.
By that calculation, yes.
And that's using your linear foot kind of analysis.
Yes.
Why wouldn't 54 out of 105 be pretty extensive?
Because it's actually 54 out of 7,000. That's the problem, and Commissioner, we all wrestle with this. The problem with, you can slice and dice these numbers any way you want. And the judge may have miscalculated. The secretary admits to miscalculating between the first brief or the PDR and the brief. We apparently made a miscalculation. The secretary, when they tried the case, forgot Area 7 totally, but didn't put any evidence on it. The problem is, all right, how do you do that? And that's why, in a sense, you need to back up and say, all right, what do they do overall in here? And let us also, when we're talking about extensiveness, let's take car marker 239, where if you look at it, it wasn't overly wide, it was potted out. Well, the problem with that is if you're an examiner, we all know when you install bolts on a pattern, and this is how the inspector is referring to it, the areas between the bolts are theoretically unsupported. They are not, but they are, you could say, well, there's no bolt in it, so it's unsupported. So if you come to car marker 239, and the only thing you're seeing at is, as by my looking at the drawing the secretary prepared, there are probably three bolts in there that there might have been problems with. That's not a lot of bolts. You can then go into, all right, how many bolts do you have in that area or the 7,000 feet? You come to, I think we said 4,200 bolts without supplemental bolts. That's the problem, is you have a standard that is a reasonable person standard, both pre-ship and this standard, and an examiner is making a judgment. And let us remember that there are two things in this case that we know about. The examiner the day before noted an area as needing additional roof support that the inspector disagreed with because he didn't cite it. And the unrelated pre-shift violation that was the second part of the case, that examiner also testified that he routinely discovered conditions and put them in the books. What we have are examiners doing their job. Now, it's a difficult job. It is not the job that an inspector's performing. This inspector was, frankly, could not perform a pre-shift examination if he were asked to because he's not certified. It's a difficult job, and to suggest by however we play with the numbers that it was extensive enough to rise to the level of unwarrantable, I think, is not appropriate.
Well, let me ask you this. I think you're getting into something that is kind of fundamental to maybe our jurisprudence. Our jurisprudence speaks of six questions to be looked at. And here the judge found danger, the judge found obviousness, and let's just assume that those findings were correct.
Right.
I mean, you question them.
We question them, but we'll...
Okay. It seems to me that the Secretary has a pretty good point here about extensiveness, that the judge erred, however you want to slice and dice it, the judge erred in the way he looked at extensiveness. And the judge, this condition existed for more than a few days, and the judge, I'm not sure how to characterize it, maybe kind of blew off that factor. He didn't consider it, really. So, but that seems like that could be significant also. So, four of the six factors are weighing toward unwarrantable, but yet, as you say, the record indicates that the examiners here seem to be trying to do their job pretty well.
I mean, yes.
The record overall, to me, does not suggest a mind that was operating with indifference or reckless disregard or the other ways that overall we've characterized unwarrantable failure. So how do you weigh the six-factor analysis against kind of an overall view, kind of a gestalt of the mind in trying to determine a question like unwarrantable failure?
Those six factors have been identified. I don't think they're the only factors. And sometimes they're a difficult fit because, for example, let's take the one on abatement. If you're issued a withdrawal order, the time it takes you to abate is irrelevant because that area of the mind is closed down. It doesn't fit. I think you also, in addition to while you look at these factors, you can never ignore the overall gestalt. I thought I was the only one who was thinking of it that way. But you can't ignore that and focus on a calculus of 4 out of 6, 3 out of 6. And in this particular case, we've got an operator who... It's unfortunate in the sense that by the time we tried this case, we didn't have the ability. If I'd gone back in on July 2008 and mapped all the supplemental support, it would have been irrelevant because it was 2 years after the fact. And they didn't map it, either the secretary or the operator. But what we do know is there was a lot of supplemental support. There was ongoing efforts to make sure that this entry was safe. And that leads me to, frankly, this whole issue, were we on notice of a greater efforts needed? I think the judge is finding that is pretty clearly supported. But let's talk about that for a minute. Weathering. The secretary says, well, that puts you on notice. Well, weathering in a coal mine or weathering of the buildings in downtown D.C. or the streets in downtown D.C. is a fact of life. And frankly, weathering doesn't go to the overall integrity of that roof. It's, shall I call it a skin problem? It affects the direct surface.
You know, the judge did make a finding of something that did go to the integrity of the roof, though. As Mr. Waldman pointed out, the sloughage of the roof, of the ribs, the judge concluded that that adversely affected the integrity of the roof for the entire width.
Well, he used the term compromise, and I'm not quite sure what he meant by compromise. What we do now is we started out with a 16-foot wide entry and an increased 5-foot. That obviously increases the length of the beam that has to be, that is supporting the overall roof. That's not a weathering issue, because that's something separate. It's supporting the overall roof. Here's the question you have to ask. Well, and Mr. Curry, who testified, who was a mining engineer, who actually had done analysis of pillar and roof stability. The question you have to say is, all right, when they installed it back in the 1970s, and they did it 16 feet wide with 3 bolts across plus straps, and they would have installed it at the time recognizing it's going to be a life of the mine entry, there's obviously a safety factor. Now, the record doesn't really address that, but let's talk about it for a moment. If you build a bridge that will hold a 120-ton truck and I run my 2-ton pickup across it, it will hold it. If I increase the stress on that bridge by running my 500-ton truck over it, yes, there's greater stress, but it will hold it. And in this case, that's the same thing. Yes, widening the entry creates some issues as to the length of the beam. But we obviously can see that we did not have catastrophic roof failure here.
Well, and you can only see it because something had to be done about it. I mean, we don't know what might have happened, but the judge's conclusion seemed to be that something bad was likely to happen.
The judge's conclusion was, yes, that something bad might happen sometime in the future.
And the miners will be exposed to that danger because of the risk or the compromise of the entire width of the entry, correct?
That is how the judge found. We would disagree with that finding.
But if the judge found that, and he's talking about the integrity of the entire width, if you're walking through that entry, you're going to walk under compromised roof. If you're riding through that entry, you're going to ride it.
You will walk under roof that has less strength than originally, but we know we've had a 30-year history here in this entry, and that entry has never failed.
Well, a lot of things never fail until they do. And when they fail, then we've got a different problem. I mean, do you have any doubt if the roof had failed and killed somebody that there'd be an unwarrantable in this case?
Well, that would be a different issue.
I mean, I don't think the standard of unwarrantable is to wait till something, the roof looks like it might fall. I mean, I think then we're in the area of an imminent danger order.
Well, we are, but
here we're looking at more than ordinary negligence, indifference, and weighing, you know, to extent, was it reasonable for the judge to conclude that we did not have unwarrantable failure in light of his findings, in light of these conditions? Because, of course, we don't reweigh the evidence. We have to look at what's it reasonable for the judge to conclude based on the evidence before him. And going to the point of the weathering, is sloughage, so wouldn't sloughage be something that's a result of sort of the age and the weathering? And I'm struggling a little bit with, there were 4 areas of sloughage that somebody went by, and it seems like sloughage would be something you'd look for in an old mine weathering. And I think, even though the record's not crystal clear when and how long it occurred, I think there was testimony from the inspector. Well, we know it doesn't occur in a shift. I mean, and I don't think there's really much dispute. Stuff sloughs off. It doesn't slough off instantaneously if you've got these areas of sloughage. There's been some time. Some of it was in an intersection, which throws it into a hazardous situation then, too, when you talk about stress. So, I think that, you know, that's what I'm
struggling with?
Well, one of the things about that intersection, Commissioner, is that that particular intersection, for all the absence of what supplemental support was shown, that intersection had posts in it, and there had been supplemental support. So that was it, frankly, as far as I can see, addressed. If I may, one of the things that is troubling about this case is when we talk to about whether there was notice to the operator that greater efforts were. I've talked about the weathering. The other element of that from the Secretary's standpoint is essentially no good deed goes unpunished. You maintained the entry. You bolted the day before. Therefore, you must have known there was a problem in these seven areas. Well, if an operator is diligent, and if an operator on an ongoing basis is doing maintenance in the entry, that should never, ever be a factor showing that they think it's hazardous or that they're on notice that greater efforts are needed. It should be recognized that when an operator does the right thing and installs bolts, installs supplemental support, and the like, that should be something that should be praised rather than that shows you're unwarned. It also doesn't, frankly, indicate there's any specific knowledge of the specific condition. It shows, if nothing else, they are going and they are identifying areas they think are problems and they're addressing them. Now, we have also gone back and forth into duration, a few days, whatever. Now, my definition of a few days is two or three, by the way.
More than a few days would be four or five.
Four or five would be several.
Jeff says more than a few days, and you say a few days is two or three, then it's at least four, right?
Or some fraction of three. Above three. That's the problem, it obviously is, we don't have a particular handle on how long the condition would have existed. If we take sloughage, for example, yes, both sloughage and weathering develops over time. Whether it would continue is another question, because you can have ribs that, and there's no evidence one way or the other, but could well have stabilized at that. Now, we also talked about the degree of danger.
Oh, well, stay. The Secretary said, Mr. Walden said in the argument, that, you know, if it's 4 or 5 days, that's 12 or 15 pre-shift examinations, that these conditions were not recorded. And if it was 7 days, which is what the miners' representative who did the walk-around said, that would be 21 pre-shifts that it hadn't been identified. And the judge found it was obvious. What I hear you saying, or the response that I've seen in your brief is, well, I couldn't see it. Well, why don't you stop there for a second? I mean, isn't that what do you make of the fact that they didn't identify it in pretty goodly number of pre-shift exams?
Well, in this particular case, well, in any case where somebody's conducting a pre-shift examination, they are not, and the regulatory history is clear on that, they're not looking for violations as such. They're looking for hazards. This particular standard, while there was a violation found, is a standard that is a reasonable man standard. We have, in this particular case, an instance where the inspector identified these areas and the pre-shift examiner on the previous shift identified a different area. And they, frankly, disagreed. While the ALJ found it was obvious. There are, that testimony has to be subject to some scrutiny, I think, because you're asking someone to look at an entry and tell that it's 16 versus 17 feet. And it's not like we've got a nice flat wall. This is a coal rib, that if it's sloughing, it may well be sloughing irregularly. You were asking, now some of the bolts, the inspector question, were bolts where the roof had potted out around the bolt, but not in the immediate area of the bolt. So the bolt's still there, it's still serving its function, which the inspector testified. It still served its function with the material between it and the bearing plate. Yes, the roof was potted out around it, but the bolt was still serving its function. That's not the sort of thing that an examiner, such as Mr. Poe, who testified, would consider a hazard. This inspector disagreed with him. So we have weathering of the roof that may or may not affect the integrity, because there were, as I recall, three total bolts where some of the bolts itself might have been showing. And how well you could see that is a question, because it's not clear on this record. You have some bolts where the bolt is doing its function, and then you have some entries that you're asking someone to eyeball it and say it's 17 feet versus 16 feet. That's a difficult task for a pre-shift examiner. It's easy for those of us handling cases to second-guess pre-shift examiners. But this examiner is going through the entry. If he's walking, he's got his cap lamp. If he's riding, he's got the assist of two lights that probably point ahead of him. But he's doing a very difficult job.
He's not carrying a measuring tape either, which
not,
the inspector did in this case.
Not generally. I mean, he doesn't have two other people to help him measure should he want to do that.
That's where I kind of come out on this. We're looking at the sort of attitude of the pre-shift inspector and the company through the 2020 hindsight of a measured foot extension of the rib in certain spots, and we're looking at an uneven wall, uneven rib that's sloughing in certain places. It strikes me as not the kind of things that jump out with you. I realize the judge made a finding that it was obvious. It's obvious that it was sloughing. I'm not sure if it was obvious to the inspector, the pre-shift inspector, that it was a hazard that needed immediate attention, particularly in light of the fact that there was a systematic approach to making sure that the roof was maintained in that area. But be that as it may, with respect to the six criteria the judge needs to follow, our case law basically says the judge has to look at each one of them, but the judge can make a determination of which ones are more weighty than others. And under the substantial evidence rule, this is what he did in this particular instance, and I don't, at this point, have a problem with the way it came out. But nevertheless, it's not that formulaic. There is a way, it seems to me, in the judge's mind, not only the six criteria, but and I love this, gestalt, of the overall approach of the operator to maintaining the roof and that entry.
Yes.
I mean, unwarrantable failure is, in my view, a characterization of attitude, not seriousness. That's what SMS is for. So if you're looking at the overall attitude of the operator to compliance here, I think that is fairly solid, notwithstanding the fact that there were seven areas that the inspector with, as they say, a measuring tape found to be inaccurate.
Don't you think, though, that you have in every case a situation where the inspector has a set of operating conditions that vary from what a pre-shift examiner is
yes.
confronted with? And the judge, it's the judge's job to sort these things out, speaking of the substantial evidence test, and speaking of the fact that, you know, we're required by our case law and the Act to give weight to his credibility determinations and his findings of fact that they're supported by substantial evidence. In this case, he did find that it was obvious, correct?
Yes, it is.
And he did conclude also that it posed a high degree of danger, correct?
That was his finding.
Okay, so what we're really left with is trying to iron out the last kink in this how bad and how expensive it was. And I guess I would disagree a little bit with Commissioner Duffy in terms of a mortal failure. Attitude is a big problem, but you can have a conscientious and well-run mind that due to a combination of factors, and we've seen this, just miss something that they should have found. And do the exercise of care under the circumstances. And this extended over multiple shifts over at least several days. And if you have a problem that's a serious risk, we found, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that you can, it doesn't have to be a week.
That's correct, but even if it is a week, that doesn't necessarily matter.
That's correct also.
Is it reckless? Is it high disregard for compliance? I mean, there are obviously cases where you should have picked it up. The question becomes, how culpable are they with respect to the level of negligence involved? And I tend to think that the moral rule is a bit higher than it's something that they should have found. That's just what I see.
Well, on the question of Gestalt, the fact that there wasn't one hazardous condition, but seven spots that were found play into the Gestalt, you know, in measuring the negligence, the indifference. It's, you know, you might miss one, you might miss two, you're going along inspecting. Seven areas that the judge found were hazardous. And material there, the size of a basketball.
That was in one area.
Yeah.
On that. I don't think, given the fact that if we're going Gestalt, I'm out of my depth on Gestalt.
You said you liked it.
I liked it, but on examination, I'm not sure I may have got out of my depth on the psychology of it. I think that even if there are seven, it is not a gray area in a specific segment of the mind that the one person is examining. So I don't think it takes it out of the fact that they are in fact diligent. I'm also out of time, seriously, I believe, if there are any more questions.
Thank you. Oh, sure.
I don't think we've touched on this here. The record shows that to abate the violation, Eastern used 66 roof bolts and 3 steel jacks. Right?
That is correct.
Now, you suggested in your brief that not all of this additional roof support was used to fix these seven areas. But I didn't see anything in the record to support that.
There's nothing in the record, one way or the other, that says what those 66 bolts were for or who actually put them in. But what we do have on the record is we have 6 drawings that if you count the number of bolts you would have to install to correct the condition identified by the inspector, and my count is it would take 25 because I count 4 bolts in a row with 15 feet of overly wide entry. What you would do is come in and install 4 more bolts in between that bolt and the rib. I come to 25. I don't think we can say that, oh yeah, they installed 66 bolts, so that shows that the condition was severe or what have you. We don't know on this record what those 66 bolts were used for.
Let me ask you this. The citation speaks of 66 bolts to abate this condition. Now, it would seem to me that if it's something other than that, the obligation would be on the operator to come forward with that evidence. And the operator has not come forward with any evidence to suggest that the 66 bolts were other than in these 7 areas. Wouldn't the absence of such evidence lead to a conclusion that or pretty much necessarily infer that they were all used to abate these 7 areas, as the secretary said in our citation.
If we have the inspector, and it's a different inspector who terminated, if we had an inspector who went in and examined where they put each of the bolts and then terminated on that basis, arguably, I could see your point, Commissioner. But when we have an inspector, as this record shows, who was told they put in 66 bolts without identifying where they were, you cannot say that it took 66 bolts.
Your client put in those bolts.
We put in those bolts, yes.
You know where they go. I would think that you would have that information, and if it's going to be resolved, you would be the party that would come forward and resolve it.
Well, Commissioner, I think there's a leap of faith that you're perhaps missing. The leap of faith is that back in 2006, in July, when it was terminated, that somebody would go in and map the bolts that were put in. That did not happen. And any point after that, and that you'd almost have to ask the boulders to identify specifically each one they put in, any point after that, you run the risk of having evidence where you're not exactly sure what was put in. And particularly once they've rock-dusted the entry again, which I assume they would do. You can't tell the new bolts from the old bolts. If you had an inspector who, if we had the inspector, if we had Mr. Wolf come in and testify, yep, they put in 66 and I went in and counted them. Other than, somebody told me they put in 66, it sounds good enough to me, we'll obey. That's not a denigration of Mr. Wolf or terminating. He was told they put in 66 bolts, it was fixed, and it got terminated. As far as I know, he did not go underground, and I don't think there's any evidence in the record that he went underground. So I'm not sure you can say 66, and it's Eastern burden to show where each of the 66 were.
And a leap of faith, it was a trust in your lawyering ability to have gotten that evidence together.
I wish we had that information. I wish we had the information because obviously we would always like for them to have gone in and mapped every inch of this area, and it wasn't done at the time. We know that they put in supplemental support over the course of time. Whether what was in any particular area other than the roof straps, we don't know, and the two posts that were mapped. But I think we have to be very careful to make assumptions about what that abatement was. If there's nothing further, I'll...
Thank you, Counselor. Thank you.
Opposing counsel challenged the ALJ's obviousness finding. Asking how a pre-shift examiner walking down the walkway could see the difference between 6 feet and 7 feet from the last bolt. The answer is that if that extra foot makes a difference that compromises the integrity of the width, the operator has to make it his business to find a way to find that extra foot.
But doesn't, when you're saying that, doesn't it have to be obvious somewhat to the operator that not only is the roof compromised by the sloughage, but it's compromised to the degree where the integrity of the, at least a substantial portion of the width, should be called into question.
Yes.
But you would agree that it would have to be obvious to that extent.
Yes. Opposing counsel also made an argument about a lot of the bolts, even though there had been potting out around them, they were still in contact with the roof. and so they're still supporting the roof. But Inspector Reinhardt only, the only area with respect to which Inspector Reinhardt testified that that was the case was the one area at the 215 car marker, where he said that there had been potting out, but it had not caused the bolts to lose their connection with the roof yet. But nevertheless, there was still a danger there because as material pots out, it falls and it could hit somebody and injure somebody. But with respect to all the other areas of potting out, the inspector specified in his testimony, with respect to each of those areas, that the bolts had in fact lost contact already with the roof.
Counsel, do we know whether these were conventional roof bolts or resin grounded bolts? Or
it's not in the record. Additionally, I think it's important to point out here that the ALJ didn't find that the extent factor was not so important in this case, but rather, I think the ALJ found the extent factor was very important. In fact, it seems to me that the ALJ's decision turns on the extent factor, because if you read the weighing paragraph at the end of the unmarkable analysis, he says it was highly dangerous and obvious. However, it wasn't extensive. And then everything after that is just moreover. Seems to me that really in the ALJ's mind, the dispositive factor was extent. So I don't think we can say that extent was not important here. The problem with the ALJ's extent analysis, though, is that he got it wrong. And again, I think I'll urge again strongly that we not get lost in the numbers. The important point is the concept. The ALJ looked at the sloughage and found that the dangerous area was only in that 1 foot where there was, in fact, sloughage, and didn't account for the fact that that sloughage affected the entire width span at that point, which is what the inspector testified to and what the ALJ credited.
Getting back, there's been a lot of discussion about the overall view of the operation of the mine and how these factors work together, and this is kind of an intricate analysis that the judge is required to perform. Wouldn't it seem that in that case a better option, if there was some problem with the extent of this factor, would be a remand for the judge to reconsider and reapply the fact?
That would be a very reasonable course for the commission to take. The secretary wouldn't have any problem with that.
And in terms of the overall operation of the mine, I mean, I just said a minute ago that I didn't think attitude was everything on an unwarrantable, but it is pretty important. And it seems titanically unfair to use evidence that of something they're trying to do to make the mine safer and to take care of conditions in one area as evidence that they knew that there was a problem in another area of the mine.
That's a very good point. I can't disagree with you there.
It seemed like you were pursuing a line of argument that was in substantial disagreement with that.
Were. But nevertheless, I'm going past my red light again. I apologize. But the point with respect to knowledge, though, remains that the ALJ, there's a very strong tension between the ALJ's finding that the violated conditions were obvious and his finding that they didn't know about it. Because if they were obvious, they should have known about it. And as I discussed before, the case law says should have known can form the basis for an unwarrantable failure analysis.
Counsel, you say that the judge got the law right. But then in characterizing Eastern's argument, you say, Eastern's argument merely summarized the evidence favorable to its position and invite the commission to reweigh the evidence. This the commission may not do. And see, I'm a critic. And what's the difference between what you're saying Eastern is asking for here and what you're asking for here?
What Eastern was asking for was the ALJ to reweigh his credibility findings. Eastern was objecting to the ALJ's crediting of Inspector Reinhardt's testimony over Safety Supervisor Curry's or the Precept Examiner Poe. an ALJ's credibility determination should not be overturned absent extraordinary circumstances. I think the commission's case law shows that. But we are not, the secretary's argument doesn't in any way turn on the ALJ's credibility determination. So that's the decision.
Well, it was more than credibility, though. It was 30 years experience with no root falls, no prior citations, and a systematic approach to supplemental roof control in that particular area of the mine. And there were a number of factors that they thought detracted from the seriousness conclusion of the
ALJ. That's true. In sum, I would just, well, I'm out of time, so I won't. So.
Thank you, Counselor. And thanks to both counselors, Mr. Walden and Mr. Moore. The commission usually holds an oral argument in response to a party's request for oral argument. In this case, there had been no motion filed for an oral argument, but counsel graciously agreed to participate and to argue the case to the commission as part of this program, and I think they both did an excellent job, and we appreciate their efforts, and the case is submitted for decision. Thank you.
Thank you, members of the commission, and Councillor Moore, and Ed, nice to see you. The things are always fun and interesting. I'm always happy to watch them.